After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Panic is just a set of physical sensations, which as a panic sufferer, I have experienced countless times and always survived. It's okay. Just let it go. Let the sensations be there. It's okay to feel it. And so what is making it worse is my resistance to it.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nichtern on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael Kammers, your host and monologist, and on behalf of all of us at Be Here Now and Dharma Moon, we sincerely hope this podcast finds you as well as can be, and we are grateful that you are joining us. Here at CSM, our guide, David Nichtern, discusses how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood with guests who embody and manifest these principles in their own life. And for this episode, we are excited to have Dan Harris joining us. It is likely anyone listening to a meditation podcast is aware of Dan and his work. However, for our purposes here, I will deliver some concise biographical info to set the table. Dan Harris is an author, podcaster, and entrepreneur who for 21 years worked as an anchor and correspondent for ABC News, hosting such shows as Nightline and the weekend editions of Good Morning America. And after having a nationally televised panic attack on GMA, Dan discovered meditation and then wrote the best-selling book, 10% Happier, as a way to encourage fellow skeptics to give the practice a shot. And now, to celebrate that book's 10th anniversary, HarperCollins is releasing a revised and updated version expanded with new material, along with an event at Symphony Space on March 28th, 2024, if you happen to be listening to this episode when it is super fresh. After that first book, Dan launched the 10% Happier app, wrote a second book, and started the 10% Happier podcast, where he interviews celebrities, entrepreneurs, authors, scientists, and meditation teachers about how to do life better, including an episode with David Nichtern, which will be running as a companion to the podcast you are currently listening to. Before getting to the discussion, briefly, we'd like to encourage everyone listening to head over to dharmamoon.com, our global online mindfulness platform helmed by David. We are currently about to begin the next iteration of our 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher training on March 22nd, 2024. If you are interested in deepening your own practice, your ability to communicate, and to transmit the view and practice of mindfulness, join us in community and become a certified mindfulness instructor with the support of our team of mentors and David as senior teacher. And if you're listening sometime down the road, we are always running lots of great programming and encourage you to stop on by dharmamoon.com. Okay, everyone, That's it for our intro. And now, on with the show. Here is Dan Harris and David Nickturn in conversation. Enjoy.
So, I'd like to welcome everybody back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast. And this week we're enriched, is what I want to say, with the presence of Dan Harris, known for many things, but for the 10% Happier book and podcast, and his everyday work with sort of bringing meditation practice and particularly mindfulness practice into the mainstream of our culture. Maybe one of the more important people doing that and making it accessible to people. So first of all, I want to say, Dan, thank you so much for joining us. It's a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
And in the moment before we started to chat, I asked Dan if it would be okay to talk about happiness and busyness and suffering and all the things, ways of characterizing our experience. So first question I want to ask you is, you zoomed in on the idea of happiness, and I was curious if you could really give a working definition of what you mean by that.
I'm still trying to figure this out, so you'll have to forgive me if I if it's obvious that that's what's happening, because I may not have like a sharp soundbite for you. But I think of happiness as an umbrella term that includes all the good stuff, mm-hmm. meaning, purpose, compassion, love, equanimity, generosity, patience, gratitude. So when sometimes people will say to me, and I've had this discussion with people like you, and I know a little bit about your point of view because we talked about it before we started rolling, and your listeners will hear it soon. Sometimes I'll hear from people like, oh, well, happiness isn't the point. And I think that's true, but it really depends on how you're defining happiness. And so for me, I've gone with the word happier or happiness, you know, in my book and podcast, because it's a word that is immediately, even if people don't know what it means, they recognize it quickly. And from there, I think it just gets more and more complex. You know, our ambivalence about the word is reflected in its etymological linguistic roots. H-A-P is the same root of the word hapless or haphazard, so it connotes luck. And that says a lot about how we as, at least in the West, view happiness as like the dependent upon exogenous factors. But I think what's revolutionary about the Eastern view of happiness, or whatever word you want to choose, well-being, is that it's not something that happens to you. It's a skill that you develop. And this concept is now being validated by neuroscience, which shows that when you meditate, you're changing often in very salutary ways, key regions of the brain associated with self-awareness, with focus, with compassion, with stress. And so that's really what I'm getting at. And I understand when people say, well, the Buddha didn't talk too much about happiness, but he didn't use that word. I think that's completely fair. And it may rest on a misunderstanding or a little bit of a different use of the word happiness, because I don't use it just to mean leaping up and down because you just won the lottery. That's more like excitement. I'm using it in a very specific way. So I don't know if any of the foregoing made sense.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, and particularly the thing that it's a wraparound for good qualities, positive qualities.
Yeah.
Yeah. If somebody wants to complain about that, they can, I guess, but you know, why would you argue against that? You know, so what's interesting to me is that as you go through the different stages of study for people who are just getting into the mindfulness piece of, I look at mindfulness as the piece that was thrown off the Buddhist bus and kind of landed and sprouted all over the place, because it is really the foundational practice of the Buddhist path, but it also has an independent stature, independent basis. So, and then you very quickly also explore things like, developing compassion, as you said, wisdom, skillful means, And what's interesting is the language, as you go through the stages of the Buddhist path, get more and more intense in a way, more vivid. So really what happens to happiness later on is you talk about it as bliss. I don't know, 10% more bliss. I mean, how that go over. And bliss has this other quality of like, it's not compared to anything. It's unreserved. And it's also married to this idea of emptiness or no particular wrap around or way you can hold onto it. It's like a teapot without a handle, you know? So how's your bliss?
How's my bliss? I mean, it comes and goes. I've had moments in my meditation practice, usually on a retreat, where I think I might be circling around what you're referring to when you say bliss. Like nothing is required in order for me to feel extreme well-being. I can be happy before anything else happens. It's not dependent upon conditions. But that is not a regular feature of my daily life.
Well, really well said. And I think for most people, my experience has been we all have a glimpse of that, but stabilizing it is one of the things they talk about in the, you know, progressive stages, like recognizing it and then stabilizing it. And only great, great masters are said to have stabilized that relationship to unconditional well-being. So, and one of the ways it's talked about is this phrase, one taste. You don't have biases anymore. You don't have judgments. If it's like right now I have COVID at this very moment, but you know, it's no different than not having COVID from a certain perspective. I'm not saying I'm at that place, but you could see that whatever experience arises is worthy of your complete attention and acceptance. So most people that I talk to at the beginning stage of meditation, which is where I'm also interested in catching people like right off the bus, like your cousin or somebody, and they go, yeah, you know, I've been sort of curious. And you talk to a lot of people like that. Is what can you say to somebody like that? Well, what they most often say is, I'm stressed out. I'm anxious. I don't sleep well. You know, so all of the first iteration of these things, that they're addressing that stuff very directly. So do you sleep well?
Depends. You know, I mean, I'm getting...
I don't mean to just keep throwing it back to you, but it's yeah.
Not at all.
Cool. Okay.
I mean, I don't want to pretend like I'm geriatric, because I know you're a couple decades older than I am, but I'm 52. And as you might remember, this is around the age when sleep for some people gets worse. And so that's definitely true for me at times. I also have, for reasons that I can't really discuss publicly, some pretty extreme work stress in my life that for the last couple of years. And so that has quite literally kept me up. Having said that, you know, it's interesting. So I'm not immune after, 14 or 15 years of meditating with some regularity. I'm not immune to the ups and downs of life. I will say, though, even though I've had some pretty rough patches over the last couple of years personally, they're still some of the best years of my life. And even though there are some times when I've lost sleep, the compounding effect of this much practice, which again, my practice is compared to you quite new, but the compounding of effect of the practice that I have personally done, I can see it and feel it paying off, even though the external circumstances are difficult.
Well, and you've shared quite publicly, it seems to me, some of the stresses that you've gone through with your work life and personal life. Is that not the case? You seem to have been...
Generally speaking, I'm totally happy to share when it's just my shit. But if it's if it involves other people who may or may not feel, you know, litigious or sensitive or whatever, I'll generally not talk about it. I'm not going to violate other people's privacy.
Who may or not feel litigious. That's good. That goes in the record book there. Yeah. Others, may all others, including those who may or may not feel litigious, be safe, be happy, be healthy, and be at ease, even if they may or may not be litigious. That's really funny. I mean, that's, of course, the thing that is happiness is also, to me, sort of related to kindness. It's really metta zone. People who know that terminology, Maitri or metta, which is a loving kindness practice that does trace back to the Buddha, by the way, that goes yes. all the way back. So, and the idea is not just cultivating sort of a field of well-being by stomping on yourself like you're a bunch of grapes and you're trying to make wine out of it, but actually going a little more tenderly on your own experience and then flipping that and being kind to other people. That seems to me like, boy, I wish we could get there, you know? I would like, and they say the future Buddha Maitreya, that's the whole deal, is loving kindness. Mm. And it's interesting, there's cycles. Supposedly, maybe 250, 300 years from now, the people who say there's going to be another Buddha like that. And it's Maitreya, who was a disciple of the Buddha that we know. And it's all about loving kindness. So it seems to me that anybody who's promoting that in this world at this time is speaking for the Buddha and speaking for the best in all of us. Because there's so much raw shit and aggression. It's almost like you can't get to anything else at times. You try to have a conversation and it's going to go there quickly. So in terms of loving kindness, do you, and particularly the litigious or not litigious, how hard is that to generate a field of loving, of at least the respect even or appreciation or kindness to people who are like, you know, in the way of your happiness? That's hard, yeah. Right? I have a hard time with that.
I have a very hard time with it. It's really hard, but it is the assignment. It's the curriculum. And I wouldn't say you should start there. I would start with somebody mildly annoying in your loving kindness practice. But yeah, I think it's aspirationally, directionally correct. It's worth working on. And I think it's helpful to give yourself a break because it is hard. And so that's basically the attitude I take for myself, which is, yeah, there are people in my life who are very difficult. And I try to understand that we're all, and this is something that my meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, has said when I've complained to him about various people over the years. We're all just acting out our stuff. Mm-hmm. And if I had come out of the wombs that my difficult people came out of and lived through the various causes and conditions that produce their minds, I'd probably be behaving in exactly the same way. And so that's how I get to warmth or understanding in that rather cognitive way, rather than just, you know, trying to force myself to, you know, feel friendliness. To
pole vault. I saw a guy on Instagram pole vaulting, and he went up like 17 feet, and then on the other side, the pole vault went up his ass.
Yeah.
It's not a crowning moment. So like that's not what we're talking about, right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. I mean, I don't think forcing yourself is going to get you there. Yeah. And I mean, there's a reason why, you know, I went with 10%. It's just like marginal messy improvement over time. I think that's, from what I can tell, I know there are cases of people who have miraculous lightning bolt awakenings, and I don't know, maybe that's true, but what I can tell based on the science I've looked at and based on the people I know in my own N of one inner laboratory, it's there's a great tweet, Roshi Joan Halifax, who's a Zen master who lives in the United States, she posted on Twitter, I get X now, and it was like a line that went, it was a very squiggly line, went all over the frame. And then the caption was "the path." And I like that. That felt right to me.
That's cool. Yeah. So, well, that, I don't know why that, I do know why that brings a slight little break in the exploration. Because Joan did have a lot to do with psychedelics at one point in her life.
Yeah.
Does that become part of your, or is that part of the litigious or not litigious? We shouldn't talk about it.
No. It's fine. So the first panic attacks I ever had in my life were smoking weed when I was 14. And so I am deeply interested in this current resurgence of psychedelics, and have had Michael Pollan on my show, and I know I have very, very many people close to me have gotten a lot out of psychedelics, but I have, you know, I continue to have panic disorder personally. And so it's the idea of taking something that in the past, you know, has And I was smoking weed when I had the panic attacks when I was 14. So that's not the exact same medicine as ayahuasca or psilocybin, but it, you know, in my mind, it feels somewhat close. And so the idea of it's, I'm scared is my, is the short version. So I'm intrigued, but scared.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I collect pith instructions, you know, pith instructions, you know what those are?
No.
Like it's an essential instruction you get from a teacher that's very short, pithy, you know, it's called pith instructions. So like, you know, Ram Dass got a pith instruction from his Guru Maharaji that said, love everybody and tell the truth. Have you ever heard that one before?
No, but I like it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's from quite a great Indian Siddha, by all people's sort of acknowledgement, somebody who had a very special kind of presence and realization. And Ram Dass, you know, for people who know Ram Dass, you know, he wrote the book Be Here Now and talks a lot about Maharaji, his guru. And, you know, if the pith instruction, doesn't matter where it came from, you're not buying the whole building and the whole neighborhood. But that is really good. I actually try to live by that. And then, of course, Ram Dass went back to Maharaji. He said, the truth is, Maharaji, I don't love everybody. That's when it turns into a koan, you know, a little bit of a brain splitter. So, you know, my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, at a certain moment, gave this instruction. It's a very interesting thing that happened. We watched a TV show together in which this guy kept falling asleep and he woke up in a world where these people were after him. And he just got more and more freaked out, you know. And then he would wake up like in a start and then, you know, he'd have to clear it away, shake it away. And then every time he went back to sleep, he went back to this same place, which was his kind of scary spot. And he started putting a gun under his pillow, you know, and then he'd wake up in the dream with the gun. And so he could, and then at a certain point in the real world, he's going crazy. So they have him in a, you know, an institution in a straitjacket. And then, you know, in the dream, they kill him. And then in the institution in real life, he has a heart attack and dies. So it's like the two worlds of his mind and his actual real life kind of intersected that complete. So I couldn't, I was on retreat with Trungpa Rinpoche. I couldn't believe A, that we were watching television. That kind of never happened before or after. And B, that this show was on. So I said, Rinpoche, what? You know, what's the message here? And he said, he panicked. He said, all he had to do was not panic. He says, don't panic. And then he said, also, don't relax when things are going well. So that was, it's always those two things, you know? So I keep that don't panic. Now, of course, obviously I'm not saying that we all can control it. Like, for example, I was in Antigua 3 days ago and almost drowned in a rip current. And I'm telling myself, don't panic. But, you know, if you feel endangered, of course, that is a triggered response. So, yeah. So what instruction have you found helpful to working with it?
Working with panic?
Yeah. Is there any kind of pith, like a pith that you could draw out of it for other people?
Yeah, I'll give you one. It's okay. This comes from Joseph Goldstein. And it doesn't mean that the situation is okay, although usually when you're panicking, the situation is okay. What it means is that it's okay to feel what you're feeling right now. Oh. And so panic is just a set of physical sensations, which as a panic sufferer, I have experienced countless times and always survived. So it's okay. Just let it go. Let the sensations be there. It's okay to feel it. And so what is making it worse is my resistance to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in this case where I almost drowned quite literally 3 days ago, I had to do certain things to kind of get out of the predicament. But it occurred to me that this might be that moment that we're talking about all the time as Buddhists. You know, it's why I say never invite a Buddhist to a cocktail party. You know, we're going to die. It's all impermanent. You know, it's like, you know, it's serious contemplation of those things. And I thought, well, Jesus, this is the moment right now. It's happening to me right now. I may not make it out of this moment. And it was then interesting to see what came up in my mind, A, and also what resources I had to navigate it. But there will be a moment where it won't be okay. And isn't that what's lurking behind the whole thing in a way is, hey, maybe it's not going to be okay. Now, I don't mean to freak you out here. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just exploring it with you because you're an explorer in this area. What if it's not going to be okay?
The expression is not meant to indicate that everything's going to be okay. It just means that it's okay to feel what you're feeling. And instead of getting and going down the toilet, resisting the feelings and then acting out of that panic and aversion.
Right.
I think it's wiser, even if everything's not going to be okay, to allow yourself to feel whatever you're feeling in your mind, in your body, and then act out of that. That degree of equanimity that is available to all of us and a trainable skill than the panic and resistance.
So you move over to the awareness, the watcher, the abstract watcher, the witness. You move over there, and the witness says, "Okay, I'm seeing this like a movie here, and
yes.
Everything in it is workable." So here's what I sort of had happen. I thought, oh shit, you know, I call it an oh shit moment. You know, it's like when your car goes off the road. Have you ever had a car accident?
Not a very serious one, no.
Okay, there's this moment where you go, holy shit, you know, this is not under my control at this point. Whatever I think about it doesn't matter, whatever I'm doing. And if you're in a position as I was to contemplate it right in the middle of that moment, I thought, I don't seem to really be afraid of death per se. That's not it. I don't want to get mauled by these rocks here. I don't want to get lost and my cousins have to figure out what happened to me. I don't want to get into a mangled body and spend the rest of my age, you know, old age as a cripple. I don't want the uncertainty of the whole thing. I want to just go back and do what I was doing. But and when I came to just that sort of complete opening of survival, there didn't seem to be anything there. In a weird way. It was all practical.
Yeah, well, that's probably your practice bearing fruit.
Or luck, as you would say, right? When you said that happiness is luck. Like that. Yeah,
I mean,
I don't
luck
know.
Luck is always there.
But it did help me to continue to be aware of the current situation. Literally, it was a current situation. Maintain some kind of awareness of where I was, where the rocks were, what my options were, how much wind I had in my lungs, you know, and then kind of focus on the, you know, very present situation. Is that part of it?
Yeah, I mean, the mind moves really quickly. So it's not like, I mean, you can have philosophical thoughts about your Dharma practice and whether or not it's working right now, whether you're afraid of death. And that can all happen in nanoseconds while you're also reflexively and instinctively looking around, gauging where you are, remembering what are the instructions when you're in a rip current, moving your body. So many things can happen within 1 second. And so I would imagine lots of stuff was happening for you quickly. And, you know, within the vast gumbo of causes and conditions that contribute to every moment of our lives, you inserted a bunch of causes and conditions in your past, which involved you training your mind, that I suspect show up in every moment of your, you know, of your existence now. And I bet made that moment, if not more successful, whatever that means, right. At least more interesting.
Well, here's one thing to throw out there about happiness, about panic. It's very lonely. That was in that moment, I felt really alone.
Yeah.
You know, and there was nothing to cling to. I thought, if I'm going down, it's like, that's it. You know, I of course thought about the succession. I thought about Ethan. I thought about, you know, Dharma Moon and all the things. But I just thought, people do die alone. That's for sure. Even if you're surrounded, they're dying alone.
You are dying alone, but I mean, in one sense, but I mean, I don't understand emptiness well enough to say whether, you know, you could look at that as like whether it was some one great Zen master who was consoling his bereft students about the fact that he was going to die, and he said something to the effect of, don't worry, nothing happens. I don't have a deep grasp of that, but on a more cognitive and more easily grokkable level, can't you summon, when you think about death, the fact that billions of people have died? You are not the first person to have this experience. And so in that sense, you're really not alone. You are taking part in a fundamental, non-negotiable aspect of the human experience.
So it's like a bar mitzvah, basically.
Yeah.
Death is a bar mitzvah. Yeah. How about that for the next book? What do you think?
It's not bad. It's not bad. I don't know how good the gifts are on the other side, but, you know, we'll see.
You know, coming back to suffering and you know, it happens to be true that a lot of people, not all by any means, who picked up Buddhism in the West in the previous decades came from a Jewish background. Did you ever think about that? That's sort of interesting.
I think about that all the time. I do. I mean, so many of the different tradition, you come out of more of a Tibetan tradition, but in the Theravadan, which is old school Buddhism, like literally the oldest school of Buddhism, so many of the big names are chewy Jewish names, like Goldstein and Salzberg, right, and Epstein and Ram Dass, who you mentioned earlier, who was a Jewish kid from Boston. His what's his real name again?
Richard Alpert.
Richard Alpert, John Kabat-Zinn, Jack Kornfield, Sylvia Boorstein. I mean, there's just, it's on and on and on. There's so many Jews involved here. And so, like, what is going on, given that Jews are such a tiny percentage of the overall population? I should say I had a bar mitzvah myself, so I'm not complaining about any of this. And I mean, I think that there are a lot of reasons for that, and not least of which we come by our anxiety honestly. what's that joke about how it's not paranoia when they're really out to get you. And I suspect some people listening to this are immediately going to the situation in the Middle East right now. I'm not apologizing for or taking sides in any way in the current events. I'm just saying that historically speaking, from the biblical stories of Egypt up to the pogroms in Eastern Europe and Russia, which drove my ancestors here, to the Holocaust and on, we've seen plenty of persecution. So we have, I think a well-developed, well-earned hypervigilance, and that does bring us to meditation and Buddhism, I think, in a pretty authentic way. I would also say that many Jewish people grow up in a rather secular environment, even though we do have bar mitzvahs. I think many of us are not particularly religious. And so there's maybe a thirst or a yearning there.
Mm. Wow. Well, and talk about having earned the hypervigilance the hard way. See, when we talk about the truth of suffering, which I love the Four Noble Truths, because it's almost like going back to the original constitution or something like that. It's like this guy's wandering through the forest. He's just had some kind of powerful realization, talking about the Buddha, everybody. And then 49 days later, doesn't say a word for 49 days. I like that part. That's good narrative development, right? Okay, we're gonna condense that for the movie, though, because we don't want people sitting there for 49 days in silence. And then he meets these people and he just starts talking. That's the way I understand it. And first thing he says is the truth of the pervasiveness of suffering in our ecosystem, in our human life stream. Then he goes, then you look at the source of it. That's a sort of good investigative reporter. What is causing that? And then you look at the cessation of it, which is to me so much, I guess it would be equivalent to being happy, but it's such an interesting thing that the source of the unhappiness has been eradicated and dissolved. and then a way to go about it. I think, like, as far as a guy developing, like, if somebody came to me with a business plan for that, I'd say, well, we should definitely develop that. You know, that's very well thought through. And then the suffering, then you get into more detail. And this is the part where I do enjoy some of the Buddhist thing, where the categories, some people don't like the categories, but I like the categories. So the four kinds of suffering, have you ever heard this one?
No.
So this is very specific. You know, the first one is not getting what you want. Simple enough, right? Second one, getting what you don't want. Okay, flip side. Third one is the flip-flopping between getting what you want and not getting what you want. She loves me not. You know, that you get kind of like you're in a revolving door of expectation and disappointment, you know. And then the fourth one is called all-pervasive suffering. It's just in the fabric. So I like to think of that as a musician. It's ground hum. Even on a good day, weather's nice. Wife was nice to me. My kid just did XYZ. You know, I just got a check in the mail from a song I wrote 40 years ago. I don't even remember it. Even then, there's a little like underneath the whole thing. That's just a sort of pervasive sense of it's not quite right. Something's awry. And those four, that I enjoy talking about that. Is that, do you think that's kind of because I'm coming from a certain angle, or is it cool, interesting in any way?
I relate to it deeply. Eckhart Tolle, with whom I've had my beefs in the past, but Eckhart Tolle has a great expression. The background static of perpetual discontent.
Oh, that's it. That's all pervasive suffering. Does he give any reference point to where he picked that up, thread up, or did he just kind of download it directly?
Well, Eckhart Tolle is like one of these guys who claims to have had an awakening and enlightenment without any actual practice. It just happened like a lightning bolt. And I don't have any evidence to prove him wrong. I also don't have any evidence to say that he's right, but you meet him. I have met him, although it's been a minute. He definitely seems like he's a different type of cat. I mean, he's an unusual dude. And so I'm inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt, but without, you know, in a loose way, because I can't say for sure it happened. I'm not in his head. But you know, people get hung up on this word suffering because the Buddha talked about it a lot. But it's it's a bit of a mistranslation, right? It's more like it's not like your life is. He's the first thing he said, or the way it's often translated, the first thing the Buddha said after his 49 days of post-enlightenment silence was life is suffering. Right, that's the translation now. But it doesn't mean life is like being chained to the rocks and having crows peck out your innards indefinitely. That's not what he was saying. Like, he was saying that life is unsatisfying if you're clinging in a world that is characterized by non-negotiable change. So the foundational insight to me of Buddhism, and again, I'm not a Buddhist scholar, so I'm very open to being corrected, and I'm reasonably new to the tradition, so I'm very open to being corrected. But my understanding of the basic insight, or the pith instruction I've heard, when one great master was asked, what's Buddhism all about? He answered, everything changes. And that impermanence, that is the foundational insight upon which the other insights seem to build. So impermanence is one, and then that builds to this idea of suffering, or what you might call unsatisfactoriness. And that suffering comes from clinging in a world where everything's changing. You know Buddhism better than I do, but does that sound roughly correct to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was cool about Buddha, he started with the apparent phenomenon and worked his way back to the source code.
Yes.
Some people will start with the source code and then, you know, it's sort of a little up in the clouds and then they bring it down.
Yes.
He started, what is some tangible that we can observe if we look at our own mind and our own experience? And I think that's very, a very cool way to go. And, you know, if you're training people to do practice, as Joseph said to you, you know, learn how to make friends with your own experience and get to know it better. That's like, again, it's just solid and good. So, then it's a question of peeling away something, and you begin to see what's underlying that apparent phenomenon, the kind of causal conditioning. And you do, you're going to right away see impermanence. Somebody starts to do mindfulness meditation. Gee, I had that thought about an hour ago, and now it's back. Where was it in the meantime? And also, you look in the mirror when you get up, and you go, is it me, or do I look 40 years older than my college picture? You know, the whole thing is just going, robbing at you with a message of impermanence. Your girlfriends drop out, you know, your job changes. It's the easiest case to make in the world, actually, and the most often resisted. You know, so I completely agree with that. And what I wanted to just add is that we had one of the good fortunes in my life, talk about luck, I'll call it dumb luck or knucklehead luck, was when I met Trungpa Rinpoche. It was before all this happened. It was 1970. And however it happened karmically, he laid the road for a lot of the great Tibetan Buddhist meditation masters to come to the United States. And we hosted them. He taught us how to host them. And so we got, you know, very close teachings from those people, like Karmapa 16 and Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. These were like the blues masters, you know, they were the really, really developed people. And so Karmapa was an amazing, there's another Karmapa now, a 17th Karmapa. But the 16th Karmapa was just, it was like looking at the sun shining. It really was one of those things where you go, nobody could miss this. Talk about happiness. I mean, it's like, this is just a kind of blazing kind of quality of warmth and fun and compassion and smart at the same time. And they asked him, somebody asked him, what does an enlightened person experience? So it was along the lines of what you just said. And he said, impermanence. That's what they experience. So yeah, I think I buy into that. Now, what happens when you look at impermanence? What happens to it? Anything? Does it change?
Impermanence itself?
Yeah.
I guess not. I haven't thought about that. That's a good question.
Yeah.
The rate of change can the rate of change.
Yeah, you could slow it down, right, to observe it more carefully. But, you know, a lot of these traditions have the notion of stopping time in various ways, you know, shamanic traditions. And have you ever had that glimpse of eternity where time kind of stops? A lot of people have had something like that.
No.
That well, just even when you notice a thought, right, you've stopped time for a moment and just simply noticed it.
I've had experiences in meditation where the resolution on my mindfulness is tuned way up, so that instead of that, I'm actually seeing how rapid the mind is instead of being stuck in the hallucination of discursive thought. So you can turn down the rate of thinking and really just be there with physical sensations, quickly passing thoughts, sounds, and you just see pew, 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 pew. It's all just that's when you see, I mean, again, this has only happened to me a couple times, where you really see with some fine grain the degree of the how impermanent everything is. And of course, one of the thoughts that comes up sometimes is, oh, I'm so fucking good at this, you know, and then you let that go and laugh at that. And and so those are very freeing moments, you know, and it can create a degree of faith and confidence that you can carry over to a day that might, like today, has been annoying on a bunch of levels. And so that memory is still in my mind stream in useful ways.
Yeah. And meaning you're pulling out maybe something creative you can do with that annoyingness. You know, maybe some action needs to be taken. And you can let go of the clinging to the texture of being annoyed as a kind of worthwhile thing to hang on to or whatever.
Yes, and also that I don't need to take all of these thoughts and moods so seriously because they too are impermanent. And also just the cellular recollection that there is a calm on offer that has nothing to do with the conditions. Because in those moments where everything slows down in meditation, where you get everything simultaneously speeds up and slows down in some way, where you're you're not so stuck in your stories. You're much more in the raw data of your senses. It doesn't matter if what you're thinking and feeling and sensing is pleasant or unpleasant, because you're not, there's nobody there really to take delivery of the package. You're not.
That's it.
Trying.
That's it. There's nobody there to take delivery of the package. That's kind of it.
That's not an original coinage. I heard it somewhere. I don't know where I heard it. It's true. You know, it's really true. And so there's some part of me, no matter how shitty things get, knows that. And so there's only the depths of despair that I can touch. Just they're not as deep as they used to be.
Right. Which is equanimity. Becca,
yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's what Joseph was saying, you know, to you know, allow yourself to think that, you know, experience that it's okay. But here's a little bit of a mind twister, because you have to visualize, like, as people got into this stuff over the centuries, a lot of time went into what has been condensed into various teachings, but people molecularly examining their experience. So one of the outcomes of that, there's this thing called the three baskets, the three bundles of teachings. And one of them is called Abhidharma. Have you ever heard of Abhidharma?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so, like a Buddhist psychology, yeah.
But it's also almost like a brain scan. It has that element of like really looking at the actual ongoing experience of mind. And mm-hmm. one of the things is, they say, you know, you can explore this for yourself, is that the experience of everyday mind is digital, not analog. In that it's frames of experience, just like, you know, film is, 24 frames per second, and video is 30, something like that. It's 128 frames per second. Your mind is clicking that fast, which is what you're seeing. And that in order for it to click that fast, there has to be, like what we say about a synthesizer envelope, it onsets from nothing, it comes out of nothing. It sustains for a certain period of time, and then it decays. And then the next one happens. And we are streaming that kind of experience and calling it our mind. But if you catch up, as you started to talk about, catching up the speed of it, you start to really, in a way, you're moving with the speed of awareness rather than the speed of discursiveness.
Yes.
And awareness is like light speed.
Yes, and it's also not you.
It's not you in a conventional sense.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And then maybe come back out of it, and there's the thing that you think is you in the conventional sense. And you go, what a cute person that is. You know, I mean, you don't have
exactly.
to be, you know. So this, you know, I talk about this till I'm blue in the face, absolute and relative truth, and the inseparability of the two. And that's really like the most important teaching I ever heard. The absolute truth.
I totally agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just going to say that because there's a way in which people could be listening to this and be like, what the fuck are these guys talking about? And it's like, you have way more experience than I do. I'm talking about like the very rare occasions where I've touched into this. You're seeing something fundamental, I think, what appears to be fundamental about the mind, maybe even the universe. And then the point of having that experience is to then take it back into your everyday life, which my everyday life is just as messy probably as anybody listening to this. It's just that I'm maybe taking my thoughts and emotions and myself less seriously and less personally. And that just makes it all way more manageable. How does that sound to you?
That sounds like equanimity. So I understand it. It's not an indifference to, you know, positive or negative circumstances arising. It's a broader perspective that you can work well with both. Might even lead to the perspective that the challenging morning you had is even more productive from a spiritual practice point of view.
Yeah.
It could take you over that hump and go like, oh, goody, they're after me. You know, that's quite a leap though, right?
The greatest title for any Dharma book ever was by, I think, Ajahn Brahm, he's a British guy, but trained in the Thai forest tradition. I apologize, Ajahn Brahm, if I've got this wrong, but he wrote a book called Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung?
That's the title of the book?
That's the title of the book.
Oh my God.
It's a fucking great title. And it really, you know, anything that happens, and particularly if it's difficult, if it's a truckload of dung, can be used to your spiritual, psychological gain. You're just training yourself to deal with whatever comes up, and including dying in a rip current in Anguilla or wherever you were.
Antigua. I wish I'd been in Anguilla. Maybe it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, well, or, you know.
Or maybe it would have been worse.
You weren't there. Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is something that Trungpa Rinpoche used to talk about. It was one of the earliest teachings that he presented coming to the West, was negative negativity. Did you ever hear that one? Negative negativity.
No.
It's sort of spiritual bypassing. You don't want to deal with that raunchy, difficult stuff. And so you create all kinds of spiritual logic and metaphysics and, you know, new age, whatever, and goody-goody and, you know, wishful thinking. But he exactly said it's the negativity, the raw emotion is actually the manure of Bodhi. That's what he called it in 1970, which the truckload of dung, and that you should relate to it directly. But any attempt to bypass it or to ignore it should be dealt with swiftly and directly with the sword of Prajna, you know, just cut it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of wrathful in the sense that you cut through confusion rather than nudge it along. But negative negativity, you know, I don't want to feel this way. I'm not proud of myself. And then also getting caught in what you think other people's impressions of you are is kind of a deadly game, right?
Yeah, there's a guy named Michael Gervais, who's a high-performance psychologist, has a whole new book about what he calls FOPO, fear of other people's opinions. And that is on the suffering menu in a prominent way. I mean, that is a great way to be unhappy.
Wow.
And I'm not say this with any judgment. I fall into that trap all the time. I guess something of a public figure for quite a while. I have a Twitter feed. I see what people are saying about me or to me or whatever. So, yeah. Your son is about to put a book out about confidence. And, you know, one of the ways to get more confident in this particular regard is to see that in Buddhism, they talk about worldly winds. I love that expression. Like there are these eight worldly winds, and one of them is like fame and disrepute. Right. And so that fame happens, you know, feel good, and then disrepute happens, and we feel bad. But can you look at it like the wind, where it's
right.
You don't judge it. It's just nature. It's just the weather. And that kind of equanimity can give you confidence, a true confidence, not a confidence that is based on requirements of like to think that things be a certain way. It's like, can I be confident with, you know, with whatever happens?
Yeah, his book is, you know, Confidence and the Eight Worldly Winds are the thread of it, success and failure, you know, hope and fear, you know, gain and loss. And we ride that cyclone. There used to be in Coney Island here, there used to be a ride called the Cyclone. You go up and down, like, you know, adrenaline boosting either way. So how do you achieve some kind of equanimity in that? And I think somehow, I don't know how this happened, but Ethan and I are kind of like on the same wavelength this year, particularly because we're talking at Dharma Moon a lot about confidence. We're having a retreat May 1st to May 5th at Menla about confidence in certain practices there are called wind horse practices. And somehow he came up with the same thing without us even talking about it at the same time. Hmm. But yeah, like confidence that's not based on causes and conditions of success and failure. That's a new kind of confidence. And, you know, it was, did you watch the Grammys this year? There was a lot to chew on about that this year, I thought.
I watched bits of the Grammys, but I don't know what you're referring to specifically.
Well, like at the end, Joni Mitchell just kind of wrote out.
Yeah.
That was unconditional confidence that she was demonstrating there.
Yeah.
She's not young. She's not beautiful. She's achieved that level of mastery where you just are not obsessed with any of that kind of stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. It was good for the younger people to see, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
you know, because otherwise it's all based on kind of the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, a lot of clinging and grasping. So I appreciate the fact that he was given that kind of respect. You know, it's stuff to chew on. I think it's, you know, a couple of things you've said in this discussion. I think Ethan is also really good at this articulating. He called it translating the translation. Have you ever heard him say that?
No.
We got a translation from something that was in Tibetan, was in Sanskrit, was in Pali, was in another culture. My crowd, we had to bring that over and go like, what the hell is this all about? And then some of the teachers were very, very powerful. Suzuki Roshi, Trungpa Rinpoche, in translating the teachings into English. There are still Tibetan teachers who are teaching it in Tibetan. Like if you do the practices, you do them in Tibetan. So Trungpa Rinpoche felt, no, we got to do it in English, your language. We got to do it so you'll understand it. And that's the translation. That took 30 years. And then now people like you and Ethan are translating the translation so that people who need a further boost into really understanding what some of the core principles are as not being exotic or esoteric can get their mind wrapped around it. So I think it's great. I'm very appreciative of it.
I mean, that is the history of Buddhism. It's just moved from culture to culture and adapted to each place. And even the Buddha himself, you could see how he changed his message, not fundamentally, but in terms of the language he used based on who he was talking to. If he was talking to fire worshipers, he used fire analogies. And if he was talking to farmers, he used agrarian analogies. And so that just seems what Ethan's trying to do, what I'm trying to do. It seems like we're just the latest iteration in a historical trend in this regard. And our kids will have to do it for us.
And do you consider yourself a Buddhist formally, officially? Is that part of your
self-identity?
Have you taken refuge?
I mean, every time I go on retreat, but I mean, the Theravada tradition is a lot less ceremonial than the Tibetan tradition that you come out of. So it's, you know, I consider myself a Buddhist the way I maybe would consider myself a journalist. In other words, it's a thing I do. Mm-hmm. I practice Buddhism as much as I can remember to do it. And so it's less for me about what rituals have I done and more about how am I living day to day, moment to moment.
And what about this whole thing that has sort of denigrated the word awake and woke? That was a clever move on behalf of the...
on behalf of the right? Yeah. I mean...
you know, like it's bad to be awake now? Is that a bad thing?
I remember the first time I remember exactly where I was the first time I heard the word woke. I was volunteering in a hospice and one of the nurses in 2016 used that word with me. And I thought it was the coolest word because, you know, we come out of the Buddhist tradition and the word Buddha literally means awake or awakened one. And so it struck me as such a cool word. We live in a, it just entered into the buzzsaw of modern digital culture and our political discourse, and which is acidic and corrosive. And so nothing stays good for that long in that context.
Isn't it also diabolically clever in a way to take the one thing that you would think of like, oh yeah, I'm proud of that, and somehow get out ahead of you on it and turn it into a toxic appellation describing you.
Well, you know, I mean, I was raised in the People's Republic of Massachusetts. Both my parents were like left of Trotsky liberals, and I'm definitely, that's the direct. I mean, I've been a newsman for 30 years, and now I'm not, so I can be honest about like what my biases are, and that's the tradition I come out of. You know. Center left, maybe even far left.
I think left of Trotsky has it pretty well covered.
Yeah. Well, that was my parents. But I think, you know, I really take seriously the injunction to try to do my best to understand the way other people view the world. And I think folks on the right would argue we didn't co-opt and ruin woke. The wokesters ruined it by by proposing things that are anathema to the vast majority of their countrymen. Again, I'm not taking a side here, but I think it is a practice in and of itself to take seriously intellectual humility and avoid epistemic closure, and to give yourself what my friend Tim Ferriss calls, what does he call it? He has a great word. I'm going to forget it, but something hives. Give yourself like a, you know, intellectual hives, because, you know, there's a coziness that we arrive at with our convictions. And even though I think you and I, and probably most, if not everybody listening to this podcast, come from the left, I think it's useful to try to understand the way other people think, and it can expose some stuff, that some assumptions you're making that, you know, might not hold up.
Yeah. I'm with you on that, because, you know, we have a problem. And, you know, it's, remember that movie, what we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yes. Yes.
You know, HUD, it was Paul Newman and HUD. What we have here is a failure to communicate. That's what we have here. And yes. I think that if the Buddhist community could come up with some kind of conflict resolution template, that would be not, you know, that could be really applicable in challenging circumstances, and actually be a good idea for a business even, you know, like there's so much conflict.
I worry that even in the Buddhist community, that there is a kind of dogmatism when it comes to political issues, and there is a reflexive liberalism. And again, I say this, you know, I consider myself both a Buddhist and, like, at least historically, you know, my sympathies run to the left. And I, you know, have pretty profound antagonism I can feel in my, that I work on, you know, vis-a-vis Trump. I think we're overlooking sometimes the Buddha. There is a huge theme in the Buddha's utterances about intellectual openness, having an open mind. He said, I myself am not a dogmatist, I'm an analyst. He said, those who cling to views and perceptions travel the world annoying people. And we should take that seriously. And that, again, that doesn't mean abandon your values and toy with cruelty or anything like that, but just to understand, why do people view things the way they do? Can I make the habit of reconsidering my own views as much as possible? So I realize some people might be pissed at me for saying all this, but that's
well. Could you just reiterate that quote? Those who travel the world,
those who cling to views and perceptions travel the world annoying people.
Okay, I think we're gonna pull that quote out and put it out over this wonderful podcast. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed, you know, hanging out with you. It's really, it feels like a very cool outpost that you're manning in space there, you know, and kind of important work. And, you know, if we can help support it in any way, we would, you know. And thank you so much for taking time out of your, I know you're very occupied these days with a lot of things. So I appreciate, you know, on behalf of the Dharma Moon community, for you joining us for this podcast. Thank you so much.
Total pleasure. Great to talk to you.
There you have it, folks. Episode number 50 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast on the Be Here Now Network. We'd like to thank everyone for tuning in, and we'd like to send an extra special thank you to Dan Harris for generously taking the time out of his busy schedule to share his insight and wisdom with us all. We greatly appreciate your work, Dan, sharing mindfulness and meditation so broadly and skillfully in our contemporary culture that even fidgety skeptics are willing to give it a try. We share a similar aspiration here at this podcast and Dharma Moon, and we sincerely hope these conversations help you, our listeners, in your practice and in your life. And if you enjoyed the show, we would appreciate it if you would hit the like button, leave a positive review, share with friends, and/or subscribe to the show, as it helps us get the word out. Before we wrap this episode, we have to give a huge shout out and thank you to the Be Here Now Network for having us as part of their podcast family. If you'd like to hear more CSM episodes, head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com/David or just head over to BeHereNetwork.com to sample the amazing and ever-growing library of conversations emanating from this world's wisdom traditions. All right, everyone, that's it for this episode. So until next time and beyond, and also retroactively through beginningless time, may you be safe, healthy, happy, and at ease. Much love.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.